I came to mind about a discussion about parenting. So I just thought I'd, I thought I'd bring it up here as a Bible study, and I titled it Blaming Parents for Behavior of Wayward and Bad Children. So we'll start by turning to Proverbs 22:6. I think I'm already on it. Says, train up children in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. And then go to Proverbs 1, verse 8. Proverbs 1, verse 8. My son, hear the instructions of the father, and forsake not the teachings of the mother. And Proverbs 4:1. Hear you children in the instructions of the father, and attend to no understanding. Nature of a biblical proverb is stated as a general principle, not as a law. For example, well, we're back in Proverbs again. For example, go to Proverbs 10:27. I seem to be hung up in Proverbs. 10:27. I'm on the wrong one. 10:27. The fear of the Lord prolongs days, but the years of the wicked shall be shortened. But there's where a proverb is more or less a general rule. However, the Bible also tells of how righteous Abel was in his life. But in Genesis 4, I won't turn to there, but in Genesis 4, it tells us of how his life was cut short by his murderous brother. But the one who done the killing, he moved on and lived many more years, though he was the wicked one. There's many more examples, all the way from Stephen to the apostles having their lives cut short. But in a similar way, we need to see that Proverbs 26 emphasizes the power and responsibility of parental influence. Time-honored principle of that offspring tend to develop in the way their parents train them, instruction, discipline, example, in their early years. However, numerous Bible characters have sons and daughters who often told different paths from their parents. King David's son Absalom rebelled in great wickedness against his father and the people of Israel as a whole. The prophet Samuel and the high priest Elijah both had children who did not follow the instructions and training of their parents. Though men in the Bible were not perfect parents, no more than we are, sometimes parents are at fault when their children turn out bad, or at least make bad decisions, but sometimes children formed from the worst parents turn out to be good and honorable adults. I got a personal friend that's got a young man working for him. His whole family, his parents, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, all of them is either in trouble, in and out of jail, doing something all the time, drugs, everything else, but this one boy could not be a greater young man. He got married a nice girl. Now they got two kids. No, they got one and one on the way, I think. And just a great man. But there's a lot of examples. There's right here in this church. I know some people that sat in this very church building before, grew up in the church, knew the ways from when they were born. They didn't turn out so good. So it's not always the parents' fault. Children have responsibility for their own choices in life. The prophet of zeal emphasized the individual responsibility on the part of parents and children. I'll paraphrase what he said, but if you want to look it up, you can read the whole thing in Ezekiel 18:20. But in my paraphrasing, it says, "The soul who sins is the one who will die. The son will not share the guilt of the father, nor will the father share the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous man will be credited to him, but the wickedness of the wicked man will be charged against him." Therefore, I believe that Jesus would offer forgiveness and not guilt to parents who seek to do their best, but our children must take responsibility for their own lives.
Title of this message is Understanding the True Meaning of God's Law, Part 1. Obviously, that's a big, big, big topic, and we'll chunk at little bits of it as time goes on. There's a shocking scripture, and you know, the first time I read it, I thought, whoa, it kind of takes your breath when you first read it. Let's go to Acts 15 and read this shocking scripture, but I think understanding this and relevant scriptures will help us understand the New Testament and God's law in the proper context. You'll see the shockingness of the scripture. Acts 15:1, certain men came down. Jerusalem was high in altitude, so whenever they go somewhere from Jerusalem, it's always come down. They'd come down from Judea, and they taught the brethren and said, "Except you be circumcised after the manner of Moses, you cannot be saved." In other words, they said, you just can't be in the church. You can't get salvation. Now, here's the shocking scripture, verse 5. This is a shocker. "But there rose up certain of the sect of the Pharisees which believed." And I have that circle. It says, "sect of the Pharisees which believed." In other words, they were Pharisees and Christians. Christians and Pharisees. Pharisees and Christians. How is that possible? Well, let me explain how it's possible to be Pharisees and Christian both. One is, obviously, if they had nailed all the laws of God in the Old Testament to the cross and said it's all done away, of course that'd be impossible, because the Pharisees, as we talked about a few weekends ago, were known for being the most arduous in law-keeping. That was their fame. As Paul said, he was a Pharisee of the Pharisee, and, you know, anyway, the point is, but they obviously didn't do that, and obviously this debate over circumcision, when if they nailed all the law to the cross, all Paul would have to say is, what are we talking about circumcision for? We got rid of all that stuff years ago. Obviously, they didn't get rid of that stuff years ago, and the church did believe in the law, but understanding the Pharisees and their approach to law and grace is something you need to understand if you're going to understand the New Testament. The number one issue in most of the epistles in the New Testament is the circumcision party, the Judaizers, whatever name you want to call them, and their battle with the Apostle Paul. And if you don't understand it in balance, you will misunderstand much of the New Testament. It's the number one controversy in the entire New Testament is the Pharisees and trying to say, wait a minute, you all are circumcised. You've got to be Jewish to be in this church. Now, somebody might think the Bible contradicts itself if you assume that the law was totally done away, because many parts of the Bible, it's clear the law wasn't. I'm not going to go over all these scriptures today. We've been over them in the past, but I'm going to list them in case you hear this video and you don't hear some of the others we've done in the past. You can write all these scriptures down and look them up. 1 Corinthians 9:9, Acts 21, 21 to 24, Romans 3:31, Romans 6:1 and 2, Romans 6:15, Romans 7:7, and we could go other verses, but those verses all clearly say that faith does not do away with the law, grace does not do away with the law, and also in Acts 24:14, Paul categorically states he believes everything that's written in the law and the prophets. That's how the Old Testament was described, because it was the only Bible that existed at that time, the law and the prophets. So does the Bible contradict itself? No, it doesn't, which is obviously it doesn't contradict itself. The question is, how do we understand this issue? And also this afternoon, as we understand this issue clearly, it would help us avoid some pitfalls. I call them Jewish fables or Jewish self-righteous pitfalls. It'll help us avoid it. By the way, the Pharisees meant separate. They were the most, at least as they perceived it, the most spiritual law-keeping sect within Judaism. And they believed that they were. Now, when they came into God's church, we assume that most of them, at least, were sincere. They probably saw the resurrected Jesus Christ or heard the apostles preaching. And there are many Old Testament scriptures, quite a few, that go along with the life of Christ, and they could, I see it. And they accepted Christ. But they still had certain spirits and attitudes they had to grow out of. And we're going to just look a little bit at the background of those Pharisees who came into God's church. We're going to look at a little bit of their background, because knowing their background is crucial to understanding why they challenged all those new Gentile converts that Paul and Barnabas, from their first missionary journey, were bringing into God's church. Let's go to Luke 2. And this is not a total comprehensive look at it, but just some major parts of what Christ said about the Pharisees. We're going to go to Luke 2 and let's see. I meant to say Mark, and I think I said Luke, and I meant to say Mark. Sorry about that. Mark 2, and we're going to pick it up in verse 23. Mark 2, 23. And it came to pass that he went through the cornfields on the Sabbath day. His disciples began as they went to pluck ears of corn. And the Pharisees said unto him, behold, why do they, meaning Christ and his disciples, on the Sabbath day that which is not lawful? Now, you're going to say, what do we mean lawful? The way the Pharisees and the Jewish leadership had described the law and the way they saw the law, they had strict limits. Actually, they had over 600 rules about Sabbath keeping. I mean, they had laws about what you could, couldn't do. By the way, it's not in the Bible. It's not in the written law that you can't do that, but it was in their law. So remember, it's their or their interpretation or their understanding of the law was illegal. Verse 25, he said unto them, have you never read what David did when he had need and was hungry, he and they that were with him, how he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar the high priest and did eat, and the showbread, which is not lawful to eat but for the priest, and gave also to them that were with him? In other words, by implication, he's saying, God is a little more flexible than you all are. Now, here's the key part. Remember the title of the sermon, A True Understanding of the True Law. Christ is going to tell the Pharisees the true meaning of the Sabbath, which they didn't get. Verse 27. And he said unto them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And if you had 600 rules of Sabbath keeping you had to worry about, can you imagine how restrictive? It'd be like a straitjacket. And that's what they did to the people. In other words, instead of the Sabbath was supposed to be a day of rest for hardworking people who had, most were agriculture in those days, worked on the farm fields and, plowing the whatever they plowed and the oats and behind oxen and all the other work they did without modern appliances. Work was hard in those days. A day off was a good thing. But they made it into an arduous religious exercise. And Christ says, no, you shouldn't make it that restrictive. Therefore, the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. Okay, so they ask you which day he's Lord. Today he's Lord of the Sabbath. Now, let's continue reading on. Mark 3, verse 1. And he entered again unto the synagogue, and there was a man there with a withered hand. By the way, there's another version of this in Matthew and Luke, and they give additional details, but I'll mention one of the additional details in a minute. They already knew that Christ did all kinds of miracles, including on the Sabbath. By the way, Christ knew all the rules the way they interpret them, as well as anybody else. He went out of his way to intentionally break their interpretation of the Sabbath laws and certain other laws and embarrass them openly. This is one case in which he embarrassed them, showing that they were wrong. And they watched him, whether he would heal on the Sabbath day that they might accuse him. And actually, some of the other versions, when he did the healing, they plotted his murder. That's how spiritual they were. And one of the other versions of this, he actually stood up right before he healed the guy because he could read their mind. He said, it's lawful if your sheep falls into a ditch on the Sabbath, for you to get him out. By the way, pulling a sheep out of a ditch is harder work than Christ simply telling a guy, be healed. Because you got to grab in the ditch and the sheep or the oxen's heavy, you got to pull it out. And it's a pretty tough job, but you're going to say, but why was it lawful to help your animals on the Sabbath but not to help people? Well, think about it. The animals were money. In an agricultural, agricultural society, a sheep was worth, a couple hundred dollars, and a cow maybe $800 or $900. That's why it's money. He says, isn't this man worth more than a sheep? And of course he would. And of course they couldn't answer his logic. They never could answer Christ's logic correctly. They just hated him for showing them up. And he said unto them, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath day or to do evil, to save life or to kill? But they held their peace. They wouldn't answer him because they knew he made them look bad and the way they interpreted it. And he looked around about them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their heart. In other words, the Pharisees and some of their cohorts, in the way they ruled over the Jewish people, they were hard-hearted. They administered the law with a cold, hard, mean way. By the way, laws are one thing. How you administer a law is a whole other thing. Let's look at our Supreme Court. The way they administer laws is something for us to worry about, as you probably well know. anyway, he told the man, stretch forth his hand. He stretched it out. And he restored the man whole. And by the way, not having hands in those days was a lot more of a handicap than it is today. And the Pharisees went forth straightway and took counsel with Herodians how they might destroy him. They didn't answer his logic, but I want to give you the attitude that they had. And how they misinterpreted God's law and misinterpreted very badly. And that is part of the problem that they had. They really misunderstood it a great deal. But Christ was humble. And let's go to Matthew 11. And here's the attitude that Christ had in administering God's law toward the people of Israel. Matthew 11, verse 29. Here's what Christ told the Jewish people, but it would apply to all of us. Take my yoke upon you. A yoke is like, you put on an ox to have him pull a plow or something. Take my yoke upon you. Learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart. In other words, Christ is humble. And you shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. He's saying that in contrast to the burden that the scribes and Pharisees put on the people. They put a heavy yoke on the people. I'm trying to give you an attitude of how the attitude that the Pharisees who came into God's church would have had before they came to God's church. I'm not going to read Matthew 19, but if you read Matthew 19, they tried to trap him, get him into the marriage divorce controversy. And again, he goes back to God's, the true intent of God's law, and shows that they didn't understand it. They didn't understand it. Let's go to Matthew 15. Look more at the same issue again. Matthew 15, verse 1. Then came Jesus, the scribes and Pharisees, which were of Jerusalem, saying, why do your disciples transgress the traditions of the elders? For they wash not their hands when they eat bread. In other words, Now, he's not talking about normal hand washing, and Christ was not for dirty hands. The Jews, actually, in some restaurants in Israel, and maybe in a few places in America, like Skokie, they have these special basins, and they go through all kinds of ritual hand washings. I read about it, but it's hard to describe it. They have to do the water and let it drip off, and it's a big rigmarole to prove that they're super clean, that nothing unclean ever enters their mouth. And all I can say is, it's an elaborate thing, and something to read about. And, of course, Christ and his disciples were more pragmatic. They didn't do all that ritual hand washing, and they, of course, criticized him for it. Verse 5, they accused him of that, and Christ counters back by accusing them by saying in verse 5, "But you say, whosoever shall say to his father or mother, it is a gift, by whatsoever you might be profited by me." And then he goes on to tell them that they're breaking the commandment of honoring your father and your mother. The way they did it, it's called korban. They would tell, a man who had elderly parents. By the way, before Social Security, children took care of their parents. That's just the way the world worked before Social Security. They would tell this young man, if you give a certain amount of money that you contribute to the temple, and of course they control the money, so you know, it's like to their advantage, you put in money to the religious system, which we control, we give you a loophole from the law about the commandments, and you don't have to take care of your parents. Make one of your siblings do it. And of course, Christ blasted them for that. And he says in verse 7, "You hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying," verse 8, "This people draws near unto me with their mouth, and they honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." In other words, the Pharisees put up a good game of, "I'm so pious, I love God so much." But God said they were wicked. Their heart was selfish, self-righteous, and they really didn't love God, but they put on a big show of loving God. "But in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." Of course, he's quoting the Old Testament. And that's what they were into. They were into the traditions that they had. Now, let me talk a little bit about their traditions. After the Babylonian captivity, although in Exodus 24, Moses said he wrote down everything God told him. But regardless of that, what the Jewish leader said was, "We have our oral traditions, which God gave Moses but didn't write down." And then in the second century, Rabbi Ben Yehuda and his associates wrote everything down, and it turned into be 6 volumes. It's bigger than what Moses wrote. 6 volumes. And then they added additional rabbinical decisions, just like our Supreme Court. Natalie was reading me a list, I think we might have left it in the car, about the seeds and and they had all kinds of rules about it. It's almost mind-numbing, all the stuff they go into. Anyway, that was the 2nd century A.D. 6 volumes of rabbis' decisions, and they are traditions of men, and Christ went out of his way. You'll see the same thing in Mark 7, to criticize the Pharisees for following their traditions instead of the written word of God. Actually, the Catholic Church says something similar. They word it differently, but their high officials have the authority that's equal to or greater than the Bible. They can change whatever they want. I mean, for those of you that maybe don't know that. So they're, Jewish people aren't the only ones that do that. But God said, "In vain do they worship me, using the traditions of men." Verse 14, and here's what Christ told his disciples regarding the Pharisees. "Let them alone. They be blind leaders of the blind. If the blind lead the blind, both fall into the ditch." He's saying the Pharisees have no spiritual eyesight. They can't see the real meaning of God's law. They don't understand it. And if you follow them, it's blind following the blind. Well, when those Pharisees got converted to Christianity, they were closer to the yoke of bondage than many of the other Jews and certainly Gentiles who came into God's church. They were closer to the blind leading the blind. And what you have in church organizations, you have people that are too far right and those that are too far left and those that are balanced in the center. And generally, when someone comes to God's church, his background comes with him. Whether he realizes it or not, his background comes with him, depending on what his previous religion was. So when the Pharisees got converted to Christianity, their Pharisaical background came with them. And that background was to be hard on people, especially Gentiles, hard on interpretation of application of the law, and they felt superior to other Jews, even more so to those unclean Gentiles. Let's go to Matthew 23 to show you what I mean. Because we have to understand the background those Pharisaical Christians came out of to understand what they were trying to do. And hopefully most of them grew out of it eventually, but I assume some of them didn't, because Paul heavily criticized them. He says, I hope they cut the organ off. I mean, that's how upset Paul was with them in Galatians 5. Anyway, Matthew 23, verse 13 and 14. But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, neither suffer you them that are entering to go unto it. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses. Now, they don't actually eat concrete and brick and wood buildings, but it means they set up rules that were hard on widows. We might call it in our world the death tax. You know, like our death tax that Congress put on people, that many farmers and small business owners, when the owner dies, if they haven't done special tax preparation in advance, when the government takes the death tax, they got to sell the farm to pay the death tax and they no longer have the farm. Well, that's what happened to a lot of widows. The way the Pharisees administered things, it was hard on widows. And for pretense, they make long prayers. And they did it out in public where everybody could see them. Oh, look at Pharisee Joe. He's so righteous. He has this long prayer. Remember that joke we told the other day about somebody always gives long prayers in church. You need to worry about them. Well, maybe that is not always true, but sometimes it is true. You want to show off too much, it's not a good sign. Anyway, 23:23. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. You pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin. In other words, they went out to the tea leaves in their garden, counted every tea leaf, and tithe punctiliously. But they have omitted the weightier matters of the law. What are the weightier matters of the law? Not tithing. They are judgment, mercy, and faith. You know, things like mercy and judgment means you got to use a little wisdom as to how you handle problems. These ought you to have done. Then he's not against tithing, but not leave the other undone. You know, they're blind guides to the blind. They're spiritually blind. They can't really see. And the real one is Luke 18. This really shows their attitude of feeling better than other people. And then we come back to the Christian Pharisees. You'll see that they still had that attitude in them. Luke 18, verse 9. Luke 18, 9. And these are the Pharisee and the publican go to the temple to pray. And he spake this parable unto certain which trusted in themselves that they were righteous. By the way, human nature is not righteous. Nobody is righteous. We all make mistakes. Not just my clerical error recently, but we all make mistakes. And you're kidding yourself if you think you're just naturally godly. And despised others. I'm emphasizing for the Pharisaical people, despised others. Two men went up in the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a publican. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, because God wasn't going to hear that prayer. Thank you that I am not as other men are. You know, these other men, they got weaknesses and problems, but I'm pious and near perfect. Extortionists, unjust, adulterers, even as this evil publican. And then he talks about how he fasts twice in the week. He probably missed four meals a week and tithe of every leaf in his garden and was so proud of it and probably bragged about it all the time. All I can say is, wow. Let me tell you a little corny story here. This town was near Big Forest, and a bunch of the churches had a whole bunch of squirrels would get in the attic and start making trouble in the church. And a bunch of squirrels got in the Methodist church, and they're causing all kind of problems. The Methodists trapped a bunch of them, took them, we're going to be nice, took them deep in the forest and let them go. They came back anyway, kept coming back. The Baptist says, we got a better plan. We'll trap them into the baptistry, and we'll drown them. And they got a bunch of them and pushed them in there. The squirrels loved the water. They were swimming all around, and they got on the sides and ran out. And even more squirrels came to enjoy the water. That didn't work. Then they went to a Jewish synagogue. You see where we're going, don't you? The Jewish synagogue workers trapped one, and they did snip, snip. They circumcised him. Never seen another squirrel again. They totally disappeared. But you realize the point of that story is really what the Pharisaical wing of the party wanted. They knew that if they told the Gentiles, you got to get circumcised before you can join this church to get salvation, you can't really be a real member until you're circumcised, they'd see very few Gentiles. I mean, there'd be some. I can just imagine some Greek person, a Roman person, coming into this church. You know, I'm trying to leave paganism to the true God. You say, I've got to do what? You're kidding me. You're kidding me. Thank you. No thanks. I mean, it would have limited the number. And that's, of course, what they wanted. And as they said, they despised, they felt better than other people and certainly better than the Gentiles. And it's clear that's exactly what they wanted, just like with the squirrels. Let's go to Galatians 2, where Paul says this categorically in no uncertain terms. So it's not just my opinion. Paul says it, Galatians 2. Now, this whole thing is about the circumcision party. Paul says many of them aren't true brothers. Christianity grew so fast, it was so electric, that many Jews kind of wanted to get in there and keep it within Judaism, best way I can put it, or undermine it. You know, in spite of the decisions made at the Jerusalem conference, after Paul left, they wouldn't face Paul because his logic and his understanding was too strong. But behind his back, they'd come in there and they said, you Gentiles, we know the Bible. We're experts. We read Hebrew. You got to be circumcised. Here's what Paul said, verse 5. To whom we gave place by subjection, no, not for an hour. Now, Paul didn't tolerate that stuff. For that the truth of the gospel might continue with you. In other words, if you Gentiles start accepting this circumcision stuff, it's going to keep the truth away from Gentiles. That's the whole point of it. And it was really quite powerful. Go to verse 11 to show you how powerful the what I call the social influence among the Pharisaical wing of the church, or some of them were false brethren. By the way, you know in Acts 10, Peter, who probably was not that pro-Gentile, God had a Gentile, uncircumcised, get the Holy Spirit, fall on him while Peter was there. Peter said, well, who was I? I had to baptize him. God was letting the church know that that's what God wanted. But in spite of all that, notice what happened in chapter 2, verse 11 of Galatians. But when Peter was come to Antioch, and that was the third largest city in the Roman Empire and the headquarters for the Gentile work of Paul and Barnabas and others, I withstood him to the face because he was to be blamed. In other words, he publicly told Peter off. For before certain came from James, in other words, from the main churches in Jerusalem, he ate with the Gentiles. But when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. In other words, those people who believe that way. By the way, Peter could not have been a reigning pope. This wouldn't make any sense. But you all know that. Peter also had a wife, too. And that's in the Bible as well. But here's what's surprising, verse 13. And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him, insomuch that Barnabas also was carried away with their dissimulation. It's hard to explain it, but I guess you call it group pressure. Maybe there are 20 leading Jewish men and women. And they went up there and they said, there probably weren't all that many Jews among the people in Antioch. And they said, you all are close social contact and eating with all these uncircumcised, unclean Gentiles. Are you crazy? And I'm not sure how it went, but the blowback, that's what I'll call it, or pushback from the right wing of the church was so great, Even Peter got caught up in it. And Barnabas. It's kind of amazing. Now, Paul straightened it out, and I'm sure Peter repented, and it all worked itself out eventually. But, and he said in verse 14, "But when I saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel, I said unto Peter before them all, if you, being a Jew, livest after the manner of Gentiles, and not as do the Jews, why compel the Gentiles to live as do the Jews?" In other words, the people in God's church were not following all the Jewish traditions. And that's what verse 14 makes it clear. If they're following all the Jewish traditions, that would not be clear. But the right wing of the church was pushing in that direction. And there were times when they got even someone as great as Peter caught up in it. As I say, the pushback was strong. Now let's go to Romans 2. We look specifically at Paul's message to Jews regarding circumcision. Romans 2:11, "For God is no respecter of persons, for there's no respecter of persons with God." Why is he saying that to Jews? Because some of them still had a problem of bias against Gentiles, and it's known human nature, it's very understandable. Verse 17, "Behold, you are called a Jew, and rest in the law, and make your boast of God." In other words, we know the law. And they did, and that's a good thing that they knew it. And they weren't like the pagans who believed in stupid idols and weird stuff and temple prostitutes. I mean, it's a good thing that they knew the law. But verse 23, Paul says, "You make your boast of the law. Through breaking the law, you dishonor God." In other words, sometimes those Jews broke God's law. That's what he's saying. Even though you boast about it, you all aren't perfect. Verse 27. And here's what he's making. I'll start in verse 26 to make the whole point. "Therefore, if the uncircumcision keeps the righteousness of the law," in other words, if uncircumcised Gentiles obey God's law, we're talking about the written law, not all the traditions, "shall not his uncircumcision be counted for circumcision? And shall not the uncircumcision which is by nature, if it fulfills the law, judge you who by the letter and circumcision transgress the law? For he is not a Jew which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew," in this case meaning spiritual Jew or a true follower of God, "which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart." It's your understanding the spirit of the law. "In the spirit and not in the letter, whose praise is not of man but of God." Now, in case you think Paul is contradicting the Old Testament, actually Deuteronomy 10:16 says that. Paul's quoting it. You know, Moses said to the Jews, "Circumcise your heart, not just your flesh." In other words, a lot of them were stealing and doing crooked things, and Paul is saying, look, the Gentiles can blaspheme God because of your bad behavior. And if these uncircumcised Gentiles do the right thing, that's just as good as if they were circumcised, because the real point of the law is to circumcise your heart. But the circumcision wing of the church didn't understand grace and law as well as they should. Now let's go back to Acts 15, and we'll take a look at some of the things that I think will clarify it. Because if you don't understand this whole section of the Bible, you just won't understand much of the controversy in many of the epistles of Paul. Almost every one of Paul's epistles, except for two, the circumcision issue is one of the major issues. Acts 15. After they discussed all this, and Peter talked about how God gave the Holy Spirit to uncircumcised Gentile, Paul and Barnabas talked about all the miracles and all the churches they raised up, and how God's Spirit obviously blessed it. In other words, if God didn't want all these uncircumcised Gentiles in his church, he wouldn't have done all those miracles, given them the Holy Spirit, and started all those churches in the empire. So the evidence was clear that God's Spirit was backing up the Gentiles did not have to be circumcised. So, but a lot of the Jewish Christians, especially the Pharisees, said, wait a minute, you want us to be in close social contact with those unclean Gentiles? Who knows what kind of things they're doing? So the church made some rules that Gentiles had to agree to. And as we said before, this was fairly easy stuff for Paul and Barnabas to tell the Gentiles to agree to. Let's read it so we get it clear. Verse 19, wherefore, and this is James speaking as the kind of the leader of all the apostles there in Jerusalem. Wherefore, my sentence is this, that we trouble not them which from among the Gentiles are turned to God, but that we write unto them that they abstain from pollutions of idols, from fornication. And by the way, everybody knows fornication is wrong, but it refers to all Leviticus 18, because there are all kinds of sexual innuendos and weird things like having sex with your daughter-in-law. But there are some pagan tribes that do that kind of stuff, and they were aware of it. So they said, you got to be sure they tell them how to define it so they don't do any of those weird things. And that would be no problem. And from things strangled and from blood, because pagans drank a lot of blood in their pagan ceremonies. Now notice verse 21. For could also be translated because Moses of old time hath in every city them that preach being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. In other words, what other things they need to learn, they'll learn as they go to the synagogues. By the way, Bibles weren't available in those days, as we talked about before. So what the church would do is they'd go to the synagogue, and someone would read certain scrolls, and they'd go back to other places in most cases, and they would then preach a sermon based on the scrolls. Later, I think they developed their own scrolls and their own buildings, but that took a few years off. So that was their ruling. Now, if you take that to mean that's the only thing you have to obey, then you can rob, steal, kill, lie. And of course, that's not what it means. It means it's just talking about ritual purity to not offend the Pharisaical wing of them. Now, let's go to verse 24. For as much as we have heard that certain which went out, this is the letter that they're writing that will be delivered to all the churches with additional witnesses so that the Pharisaical party can't undermine it. They still tried anyway, but for as much as we've heard that certain men went out from us and troubled you with words subverting your souls. Now, these are the words that the Pharisees said subverting their souls. This is not what the church said, saying you must be circumcised and keep the law to whom we gave no such commandment. And it's their interpretation of the law. Their interpretation of the law was you got to be circumcised. Even if you're an adult non-Jew, you have to be circumcised. And the church is saying, no, that is not what we said. And that's their interpretation of the law. That's not how we see the law. It's what the Pharisees said, and they're saying, no, that's not true. Now, just to prove our point, this is probably 49 to 50 or so A.D., somewhere around in there. Let's go to chapter 21, and this is roughly 60 A.D., so it's probably 10, 11, depends on who's count, 10, 11, 12 years later, depending on whose count you make. Paul's made two more great missionary journeys, raised up all kinds of churches, and he goes to Jerusalem to witness to the Jews one final time. It's a great story to read, but I want to just pick out verse 21 to 24. Well, I'll start in verse 20 because it all fits in together. Verse 20, Acts 21. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord. In other words, all the great churches that Paul raised up and all the great miracles that he had done in his three missionary journeys. And they said to him, you see, brother, how many thousands of Jews there which believe. In other words, they've become Christians. And they are all zealous of the law. Notice, so many of those who are zealous of the law would have been former Pharisees, or they still believe you could be a Pharisee and a Christian. And they're zealous of the law. And they're informed of you that you teach all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying they ought not to circumcise their children, which Paul did not teach that, neither to walk after the customs. Paul did not teach that unless the traditions were bad, like we've talked about already. What it is, therefore, the multitude must needs come together, and they will hear that you're come. In other words, Paul was such a celebrity in the Jewish world, there's no way they could keep his coming to Jerusalem a secret. When you read the whole context of it, mobs of thousands of people came out regarding Paul. And his enemies in other parts of the empire told the other Jews, this Paul is raising up a lot of churches, and he's pulling a fair amount of Jews into a church with uncircumcised Gentiles, and we don't like what he's doing, and he's evil, he's bad. And, of course, they lie. What can I say? They distort it. But notice, verse 23 and 24. Do therefore that This that we say to you, we have four men which have a vow to them. This is a temple thing for Jewish people to do. Then take, purify yourself with them, be at charges with them, that they may shave their heads, and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning you are nothing. In other words, that Paul is teaching against the law. Notice, it says that those things that they say about you are nothing. Now, there's no way you can play games with the English. It says what it says. Paul was not teaching against the law, as we mentioned all those other scriptures that you can go read as well. Wherefore, they informed concerning you are nothing, but that you yourself also walk orderly and keep the law. And that's pretty clear. And this is a number of years later. So the problem is the way the circumcision party did it. Let me bring up three issues, which I was talking to a minister last night. Actually, he brought, and a couple days ago, both of these issues came up. One is the Jews, at least the conservative Jews, the modern-day people of the Pharisees, they believe you can't drive a car on the Sabbath. And that's fine if you live, say, within a mile or so of the synagogue. It's a nice, pleasant walk, and many do that. But there was a lady, an older lady, was somewhere in Kentucky, as a matter of fact, and I'm not upset with her or anything at all. I'm just explaining what this minister explained to me. It was like 99 degrees on one of our holy days, really hot, and he saw her after church walking home. He had a car, and he pulled over, and he said, elderly ladies, would you like a ride in my air-conditioned car back to your house? How far do you have to go? She says, about 2 or 3 miles. I can walk. He said, why don't you take a ride? She says, no, I don't believe in riding in a car on the Sabbath. So she walked 2 to 3 miles on the hot streets of a city in Kentucky rather than take probably a five-minute ride in an air-conditioned car, because she was taught that's better to keep the Sabbath. Another case, there's a man who believed that you can't eat in a restaurant on the Sabbath. We won't go into all the logic of it. And as he was telling one of our ministers about it, and he was also bragging about how much he prays on the Sabbath. And our minister says he's looking for a church that gives him all kinds of rules about Sabbath keeping. That's what he needs. That's what he wants. That's not good for him. And then there was a time when some people came up with 25-hour Sabbath. That is, you start a half hour early, you end a half hour late, just to be sure you're super righteous. Well, those kinds of things are really not healthy. They're self-righteous. You're trying to out-righteous people. And actually, it's bad to brag to other people about how much you pray. The minister told the guy, he said, well, if you do all that praying, that's fine, but keep it to yourself. You lose credit with God when you start bragging to other people about how righteous you are. Let me read part of this little article. This was in our newspaper about the Hasidic Jews in Jerusalem. There's a special pair of glasses for the extreme ultra-Orthodox Jewish men who shun contact with the opposite sex. After a few meters, the vision is blurred. So unless a woman is right in front of them, they can't see her too clearly. And they do that because the way they run their neighborhoods in Jerusalem, the women and men sit in separate parts of the bus, separate parts of the sidewalk, separate parts of the synagogue, and other public spaces. They interpret Jewish law to forbid contact between men and women who are not married. By the way, Islamic people also borrowed that same thing from Judaism, and you see some of the extremes that they go through. Anyway, we'll go through the whole rest of the article, but they complain about the other non-ultra Jewish women in their immodest clothing. But you can see the problem. We have to avoid getting into Jewish fables, Jewish traditions. We need to stay humble. Don't believe you're better than other people. Don't try to out-righteous other people. Our standard is Jesus Christ. And if you're trying to measure up to Jesus Christ, you're always going to be struggling. You're always going to be down here looking up. If you measure yourself with old Joe and you say, I'm better than Joe, and you kind of outrighteous him, and well, that doesn't prove anything, and God doesn't like it. Never brag about how much you pray and how righteous you are. It should be between you and God. And remember, our standard is Jesus Christ. And you don't want to feel better than other people. You don't look down on other people. You want to stay humble and continue to try and grow like Jesus Christ and avoid the pressures, and I didn't mention them all, towards self-righteousness that I can see gobbling up some people, even in God's church today.